Thank you. You might have seen the posters up around that announced our AFK event, and there were some of us that didn't know what that meant, and so we had to look it up and find out what that was. And you know, like any poet, any creative-minded person, if you don't know what it means, then you're going to make up something. And so I want to start with something that I read that is my AFK poem. This was written after I did find out what it was. So, but anyway, this is my AFK poem. Away from his keyboard, John is awake for keeps. He's armed from Kentucky, a new soldier, training at Fort Knox, learning to fight. He's arriving from Kansas, where school let out forever, and they took the crucifix down to open a gymnasium. He's after a 5K, standing in sweaty shorts, checking his time, chatting with other runners. He's almost forgetting Keith, his one-time roommate, who slid through the siliconed hallway and dived the rocky cliffs at Sheridan Lake and swam the caves of Rapid Creek until wrong-way headlights canceled his plans. He's asking for Karen, who makes the best frozen concoction we call slush, a mix of orange juice and peach brandy, a remedy for summer. He's always flying kites in his imagination, swooping and diving through time and place, drifting through memory and hope, keeping his mind astir, his hopes afloat, his ready dreams aloft. What can stop this drifting but having a job to do, a 9 o'clock appointment at his freaking keyboard once again? I'm part of the multicultural movement here at Dakota State, at least sometimes. There's a distinction between us West River South Dakotans and East River folks. And so I'm going to read a couple of things that are sort of West River poems. I grew up with, my dad was a cowboy when he was a young man and worked cattle all his life. Basically, he was the Stock Growers Association investigator. When people got their cows stolen, they would call my dad, and he was sort of this cattle detective. I learned a lot of things from him, and one of the things is this poem is the subject of learning to cuss. I learned to cuss from my dad and from being a cowboy. So this is sort of a recipe for learning to cuss. There should be a cow going through a fence, bellowing and kicking, its calf going its own way down a hill. The fence is strained and creaking, the cow already through the top strand, wire twanged back on wood posts, the Hereford's left rear hoof twisted in the barbs. You should be on the little white horse that won't stop after building to a run, who shirks and shies away from wire and cows and fence posts, who turns away now as the cow jerks free, its rear leg bloody, its head high, eyes wild, heading over the hill into a neighbor's pasture. You've got a sandwich in your pocket. It's getting further from lunch. You've missed the first class seats and have an orchestra view for the unfolding enterprise, your documentary of cowhide, horses that won't handle, fences that need fixing. The only thing lacking is a narrator whose commentary seems relevant, abundant, and pointed as barbed wire. That's how I learned to cuss. One of the things that I've also done is write some pieces that are sort of memoirs of growing up in this family where we had 10 kids I had six brothers, and my dad had high hopes for us, his sons especially. And this is a little piece about being in a rodeo, my first and last rodeo. It's not a poem. Late in life, my dad called himself a pretty fair antique maker. The people who turned up at his flea market stand frequently couldn't tell between his antique rocking horses and the real thing. At one time, though, years ago, he fancied himself a pretty good rodeo rider, and even into his 40s, he could still sit aboard a rangy horse. I never saw him get thrown. He was a team roper, too, at one time before he had all 10 kids. He could still drop a loop delicately under a running calf to catch its hind legs and drop it, same as when we were kids out in the front yard where he would practice. "Run by, John, and beller like a calf," he'd say. So I would, and as much as I might beller and kick and balk, when I ran by, kicking my heels in the air, his loop would appear out of nowhere and I'd be on the ground, one foot circled by his nylon rope. Dad had 7 boys, and he was sure that one, at least, would make a good bull rider. My older brother Joe usually got the prompting, since he was sturdy, built like a wrestler. Dad joked about how he had been going to nail Joe's boots to a board, toes pointed out, and have him sleep that way so his toes would turn out like a good bull rider's. My younger brother, too, was good potential. A swaggering 4-year-old, Jim used to repeat in his gravelly voice as Dad had taught him, "I'm Buster Nelson, and I'm the toughest kid in town." I was thinner, wore glasses, less prone to violence. Jim and I practiced riding at the local brandings where we rode calves and yearlings when we turned them loose. Without bull riggings, though, the ride was rarely more than a couple of crow hops that left us on the ground. We had seen rodeos. The Stanley County Fairgrounds was only a block away from our front yard. But our first ride was a Little Britches rodeo up in Mobridge, South Dakota, when I was about 12 and Jim 10. Though Joe and Jim each made a few other attempts, this rodeo proved to be my first and last for what I thought were very good reasons. We were registered for the bull riding, and Dad had worked us up for the day. We each had the right equipment, hats, boots, spurs with their rowels taped so they'd hold you on a bull, homemade leather chaps, jeans, gloves, and a little rosin for a good grip. Best of all, Dad made us each a bull rigging. The rigging evolved as Dad braided the twine strands against the swing set out in the backyard, and he built the handle with the rigging cinched tight around the bull. The handle, with your palm already underneath, would grip your hand for a firm hold. He showed us how it worked. With a good rigging like this, he told us, we could hardly fall off. On top of it all, Dad found us each a good cowbell to mount on the belly side to pull the rigging loose after the ride. After the bull would buck, the crowd would hear the cowbell clanking, see us there riding high, one gloved hand on the rigging, the other hand waving. Bull riders. When we arrived at the Mobridge Arena, the other kids either had store-bought riggings or a simple piece of rope, which cinched the hand down tightly against the bull. Ours were better, custom-made. With our contestant numbers newly pinned to our backs, Jim and I hooked our riggings to the corrals behind the chutes and stood in full dress, even with our jeans tucked into our boots, and began to work the sticky rosin into the rigging handles. Dad reminded us we had to pick the rigging up after the ride. As any sportsman knows, a man's success or failure may hang on the proper care of his equipment. The bull riding began. We watched the bulls run up to the chutes, kids and their fathers watching while the announcer called each name, and the kids climbed aboard their draw, cinched down the rigging on and the flanking cinch just ahead of the bull's back legs to make him buck, and nodded for the chute. Next, the bull leaped from the chute and the kid was jolted clear of the bull, 7 seconds short of the 8 he was supposed to stay aboard. "Give that cowboy a big hand," the announcer would call. Well, the kid got up from the dirt, dusted himself off, and stumbled to collect his hat and rigging while the clown ran the bull out of the arena. The next anxious kid was already settling himself down to the next restless bull. The bulls were young, 2-year-old Brahmas, not ready for the big circuit, but big. They would become good rodeo stock. Some had even begun to grow the recognizable shoulder hump, and though most were the size of an adult Hereford, some were bigger, with horns and humps and the proper fighting attitude. For the ride, it depended on the